So we're going to have a lecture on magnitudes today. So the last lecture we had a one lecture on the enormous subject of locating earthquakes, and today we're going to have a single lecture on the enormous subject of earthquake magnitudes. And again, prepare yourselves for some surprising concepts. And like last week, I shall be asking some questions of the audience here. And if I pick on somebody and they say, oh, sorry, I wasn't listening, then obviously that's going to go on the podcast, isn't it? Okay, so the first amazing piece of information is that there's no such thing as a Richter magnitude. Despite what you hear on the television and the newspapers and the web and blah, 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 the Richter magnitude, the concept of that is something invented by the media. Okay. What they call Richter magnitude is in fact generally ML, and everybody will immediately see that L is not the letter that starts Richter, is it? Richter starts with an R, and if this is a Richter magnitude, it would be obviously MR, wouldn't it? ML is the local magnitude scale, and it was invented by Charles Richter, but it's not called the Richter magnitude scale. Okay, here's a picture of Charles Richter. He was a very clever guy, and he was one of the people who laid the very basic foundations of earthquake seismology. And if you're interested in him, you can always ask Professor Julian, who's the visiting research fellow here at the moment. He won't be here for very much longer, but he'll be coming back in the spring sometime, because he knew this character personally. Okay, unlike me, Charles Richter was highly contemptuous and very intolerant of students. And students would often go and ask him questions in his basement, all full of seismograms. And if you wanted to do earthquake seismology, you had to go to Charles Richter's basement and ask him to give you some paper records. And he was often heard yelling and screaming at students for asking simple questions. You know, why don't you know that? Apparently it was quite unpleasant, could be heard between walls in the apartment. But he was a very clever guy. And when he was working, he realised that there was a need for measuring the size of earthquakes. So he was working in California there, and there'd be earthquakes, people would feel them, people would want to know if this was a big earthquake, if their friends in the next valley had been injured or houses damaged and so forth. And he had to say, oh, this is a big one, no, this is just a medium one, or no, this is just a small one, which just happens to be very close to you. But he realised that the small, medium and large way of measuring, you know, describing an earthquake was not good enough, so he tried to come up with a mathematical description of this. He also realised that some earthquakes were absolutely ginormously powerful, and others were just little local things which didn't bother anybody, didn't even frighten the chickens. So he realised he had to use a logarithmic scale. Okay, so this is similar to the star intensity scale, where if you go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, then you're going up a logarithmic scale. You're not just multiplying by 2 or something like this, or adding a constant amount. So local magnitude equals log to base 10 of A, where A is the maximum amplitude in millimetres measured off a seismogram. So here we have some seismograms. Take the measuring rule, you saw it's 5 millimetres, and you could plug it in here. But Richter realised that on many seismograms, the amplitudes were much smaller than that. So even though we've got millimetres here, there were still records being made of earthquakes that were smaller than a millimetre in amplitude. And if we just had this part of the equation, supposing you measured the amplitude to be 0.1 of a millimetre, what magnitude would you get? -1. You'd get -1, and Charles Richter thought that people wouldn't be happy with that, you know, if they had some damage or other, and they were told this is -1, they would say, well, you scientists are all crazy, how can you have a negative magnitude? So he added this second term to try to make all the magnitudes positive. The second term is log to base 10 of the amplitude of a standard earthquake. So he rummages through his pile of seismograms, he picks out an earthquake that's so small, he thinks nobody's ever going to be interested in an earthquake smaller than this, because no one will feel it. same distance as your earthquake if it was the standard earthquake. Okay? So what you have to do, okay, talk about that in a minute. So A0 is the maximum amplitudes at the epicentral distance of the earthquake you're interested in for Richter's standard zero earthquake. And his standard zero earthquake was one which had an amplitude of 0.001 millimetres at 100 kilometres. So I'm just in awe that anybody could measure such a small amount. It really makes you wonder. So, first question. Supposing you've got an earthquake here, and you measure its amplitude, and you get 5 millimetres. And supposing you... let's re-zero that again. Supposing you've got... You measure an earthquake, and you measure its amplitude to be 0.1 millimetres. I hope everybody is writing this down. I can see everybody pouncing on their notepad. 0.1 millimetres. And supposing the A0 here, you calculate the distance of your earthquake, you look up A0 in a table, and that gives you an amplitude of, say, 5 millimetres. So would you... Okay, we'll say that's 10 millimetres, okay? So say this is 0.1 millimetre, and this is 10 millimetres.
Minus 2,
yes. So let's try another example. Supposing this is 0.1 millimetres, and this is 0.2 millimetres. 0.01 millimetres. 0.1, 0.01. I hope everybody could see that if you just had this first term, you'd get an amplitude, you'd get a magnitude of minus 1. But if this, if A0 is 0.01, then this here, log to base 10 of that, is minus 2. And because there's a minus sign here, that makes plus 2. So you've got minus 1 plus 2, which is plus 1. So this second term is basically, it's having the effect of a very, very small earthquake. It's pushing it up so that it has a positive magnitude. After Richter had done his work, and he'd probably passed away before it became the case, but people rapidly started being interested in earthquakes that were smaller than one. So in my own PhD thesis, for example, which was published in the 80s, you know, I've got a lot of earthquakes, even down to magnitude minus 2, and now this is sort of daily bread. You know, I mean, even when I published that, seismologists were saying to me, what's this? You have a minus magnitude. And people had not kind of taken this on board, really, because they were just not used to dealing with little teensy-weensy earthquakes. But I was dealing with earthquakes that were geothermally induced, very small local earthquakes. We see similar earthquakes when we look at fracking projects. Often when you look at fracking projects or you look at other hydraulic injection projects, you don't see any earthquakes with a positive magnitude. So we're living in a negative world now. This is what you do in practice, and this is what you'll be doing in the practical. You'll look at your earthquake, you'll measure the amplitude, you'll calculate its epicentral distance from where your seismograph was. You will look up log base 10 of A0 at that particular distance in a table, and you will just simply plug it into the equation and your magnitude will pop out. So when I first started working in the subject, there was one of these things with sellotape to the desk in the seismograph room, and what you would do would be to look at your earthquake here. Here is a distance scale in 0 to 500 kilometres. And this is the equivalent in S minus P time. So instead of calculating the distance, you could simply measure the S minus P time, multiply by 8. Well, you didn't even have to do that because this is in seconds. So you could measure the S minus P time. If that was 6 seconds, you would put to your ruler here on the 6. You would then measure the amplitude, which is this here. And if that was 10 millimetres, you put the other end of your ruler here, and where it passed through this scale, that gave you your magnitude. So you can see that it was... Yes, sir?
If you were, when you're using the S minus P version of the scale rather than...
important aspect of an earthquake seismologist's work. A lot of earthquake seismologists are engaged in hazard reduction. And I don't know if anybody clicked onto this, but there was recently a very bad, well, you probably didn't know. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? There was a damaging earthquake in Italy, and I think 100 people or so were killed, weren't they? And there was a big controversy because the seismologists said things which many people felt encouraged people to stay indoors when they should have gone outside for safety. And so many people feel that the earthquake seismologists, because of their advice, caused more people to be killed. So of course this is, if you go online, you can, it's called the Quillo earthquake, is that right?
No, yeah.
Give three PowerPoint slides explaining to the class about this earthquake. And if you think that's not fair, you should be thanking me for giving you this opportunity. I could always give the rest an example sheet to work through to make up the extra work you're got to do. Shall I do that?
No.
Okay, Mario's happy to give us three slides. And he has requested that he doesn't want the rest of you to be burdened with an amount of work.
Because then I would be killing you.
A few wine bottles should come all around. Everybody should try to get an opportunity to do a bit of public speaking if they can. I'm actually doing Mario a favour here. And as you know, those of you in Challengers group, we've got eight groups, and so eight or maybe more, I don't know, people will be giving PowerPoint presentations, and you should grab the opportunity if you can to give those presentations, because you're going to have to go to job interviews, or you're going to have to go to interviews, applying for PhDs and whatnot, and the more experience you can get speaking to a group, supposing you go to a job interview with some company, and they say, oh, this is an interesting project that you did, we're going to have a panel of five people interviewing, and we'd like you to give a 5-minute PowerPoint presentation on your project. Certainly, I recently interviewed five people for a postdoc, and made them all give a 10-minute presentation first, so we could see how they performed. So, practice is good. Okay, so now, of course, we don't do it by hand like this. We have computer programs, and computers automatically output this information for you, and you can go straight on the web, so newspaper reporters don't even have to call you up and ask you. But I just thought I'd show you a pre-computer computer program, because this surprised me when I first saw it. Okay, this is a computer program that was written before computers existed. And it says, Miss Froelich, will you please integrate empirically the following relation and tabulate y as a function of x over the range 0 is less than or equal to x less than or equal to 221, comma, delta x equals 0.5, cotangent of 5 equals blah, 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 blah. Thank you, René Julien, date 1945. Before computers were available, if engineers, this is the father of Dr. Julien, okay, and he worked on some of the NASA space programs, sending up on satellites, some moon missions, worked basically fundamental to that. And back in those days, computers were not readily available, and what you had was an office full of ladies, okay, who were all ace mathematicians, and if you wanted something like this calculating, you just wrote out a piece of paper like that and you sent it into the computer pool. So these ladies were called computers, and a lot of women are very good at mathematics, and these people were invariably women. I don't know quite why that was. I mean, women are good at maths, but men like telling women what to do, don't they? So maybe that could be something. So, back in those days, it was kind of a little bit down market to be good at maths or to be doing this. This was not necessarily a highly respected job of work, because the work that women do is not respected because it's done by women. Of course, nowadays, mathematics is now thought to be a very high pressure. Maybe I should have stopped the podcast. Anyway, we have here a mixed group of male and female students, all of which are good at mathematics, and that is everybody hopefully is recognised for their intrinsic abilities and not their gender, race, colour, sexuality, religion or anything else, and that is how everything should be. Sorry about this, everybody. Okay, let's move on to the science. There are other magnitude scales. There's a surface wave magnitude scale, which is known as MS, and then you measure the amplitude of the surface waves, not the body waves. There's a so-called body wave magnitude, MB, which is somewhat differently defined from the local magnitude scale. And there's the duration magnitude, MD. So this is quite a handy one because you can just measure the length of the earthquake and you don't have to calculate its epicentral distance from the recorder. So how do all these different magnitudes compare with one another? So here, for example, we're comparing the surface wave magnitude with the local magnitude. And this red line is the one-to-one. Okay. So if these two magnitude scales agreed, everything would lie on this red line. But people have taken large numbers of earthquakes and they've plotted them all up to see if this is true or not, and they get something that looks like this blue line. In other words, if you take an earthquake that some advertisers having a local magnitude of 3, it's likely to have a surface wave magnitude of 1. If it's got a surface wave magnitude of, say, 8, the local magnitude is likely to have been advertised as being about 7.5. And this is because these magnitude scales are just defined empirically. You measure this, plug it into that equation, get a number out. It doesn't say anything about focusing, it doesn't say anything about wave propagation, it doesn't say anything about focal mechanism, which can affect your amplitude measurements. It doesn't even say anything about the instrument you used. The local magnitude scale was first designed for a specific instrument called Wood Anderson seismograph, but now we're using all different kinds of seismographs, and nobody takes any notice of what kind of seismograph they've got at all. So you can see from this that the magnitude is not a fundamental property. And it's not meaningful to talk about the accuracy of the magnitude. If you pick up the Daily Mail and it says the earthquake was 8.5, and you pick up the Daily Telegraph and it says it's magnitude 7.5, you know, it's completely, you don't discuss which is the most accurate or which is the correct, because there's no such thing as a correct magnitude. If you've done your measurements, you know, in the defined way from some seismograph and you've got some number, then that's the number you get. And, you know, there's no way of proving whether that's right or not. So this is a sort of counterintuitive thing. Okay, seismologists have done quite a lot of work over the years, which has produced some interesting results, just empirically correlating one thing with another. Okay, one thing they've done is to come up with this relationship for the amount of energy expended by an earthquake when it occurs, and they've empirically derived this equation, 11.8 plus or minus 1.5 times the surface wave magnitude. And you can readily read how they've managed to come to this if you look at one of the recommended textbooks. So the question is, if we go up one unit in MS, if we compare, say, a magnitude 6 with a magnitude 7, by what factor does the amount of energy increase? I want everybody to pull out their calculators and see who's the first to answer this question.
Thank you.
he will win a grand prize. On to intensity. So in theory, if you measure magnitude, you know, you should get more or less kind of the same ballpark result if you go from seismograph to seismograph, but intensity is different. If you're close to the earthquake, you'll feel a strong intensity. If you're a long way away, you won't feel it at all. So magnitude is measured on the Mercalli scale, and there are many other scales too. So one, people do not feel any earth movement. So there could be an earthquake going on now. We could now be experiencing intensity one because we can't feel anything. However, of course, when it goes up here, drivers have trouble steering. That's magnitude 8. Most buildings and foundations are destroyed, magnitude 10. And you can immediately see that this is sort of culturally dependent. So there are different scales, for example, for Pacific Islands, where the experience of the intensity is expressed as palm trees swaying and this kind of thing, because people don't necessarily have cars, for example, on Pitcairn Island. And you know, in other places, if you're in the middle of a big city and there are high-rise buildings, or you're out in an agricultural area, then obviously the description of this is going to be somewhat different. So very, very empirical here. This is an intensity map of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, which occurred here. San Francisco is here. And you can see this goes from, let me see now, 8, this is 9, that's 10, so the darkest red is 10. So you can see the strongest shaking was all the way, you know, a linear zone. Okay. So this was actually a very important observation in understanding exactly what causes earthquakes. This was one of the observations that H.F. Reed made when he developed his theory that earthquakes were caused by slippage or faults, because there was this long linear zone. Most of the work that had been done on earthquakes up to then had been done in Japan, and many of the strong earthquakes in Japan are offshore in the trenches, you know, or deep. And the damage on land would tend to be just chaotic. Everything, landslides, buildings falling down, just all over the place, and no systematic geological effects that could be looked at. So people had this notion that there was some an explosion happening under the ground or something like this. People didn't know what caused earthquakes from the Japanese observations. It wasn't until this earthquake occurred that a geologist, H.F. Reed, who was a basin range geologist, he realised that earthquakes occurred on faults. And of course, this pretty picture here has been put together by looking at newspaper reports, reading people's letters to one another, descriptions of what happened on this, that and the other farm, and estimating a posteriori what sort of strength of shaking people experienced. Okay, seismic moment. We now don't talk about magnitudes. Of course, the newspapers do. They phone up and you give them a magnitude, which is a number between, you know, like 3 and 10. But seismologists think in terms of seismic moment, and the seismic moment is the amount of shear stress relieved by the source. And it's theoretically equal to the shear modulus mu times the fault area times the average slip. So this is the amount of shear stress relieved at the source, and it has the units of work. It has the units of, in SI, this is Newton meters. But you very often see dyne centimetres, which is the CGS system. So it's in the same units as work, which kind of makes sense. So, simplistically, there are two ways of calculating the moment. You can either just use the surface break and the amount of slip, or you can use spectral analysis. So describing this to begin with, you take a look and you see how much of the fault has broken, how many hundreds of kilometres in this case. This is what the 1906 break looked like. This is H.F. Reed's girlfriend. And I think nobody took some research to find out what her name was, because back in those days, this of course had to be all very to look at some of these places where this occurred. This is a road now. You can drive a car, and you can still sort of see a bit of a mess left over where this occurred. And you know, here's a measure of the amount of slip of the order of meters. So using the numerical method, of course, you would take a spectrum, and here we're looking at an earthquake spectrum. Typical of what they look like. So this is the these are all logarithmic scales. Earthquake seismology is plagued with logarithmic scales. Here we've got the log of the frequency of the seismic signal, that component of the earthquake, and here we've got the amplitude. I'm afraid this scale has got chopped off. This is very typical that at low frequencies you get what is in theory a plateau. Theory it's a plateau, not terribly plateau-like. And then the energy falls off very rapidly as the frequencies get large. So large earthquakes have got a lot of energy in the long periods. And you could actually see that from the seismograms I showed in the first lecture, where you know, the P wave is really tiny and then the surface waves are really huge. That's where all the energy is. And basically you measure the amplitude of the long the low frequency energy, so that would be 2 × 10^26. Because newspaper reporters, when they ask what the size of an earthquake was, they don't want to be told it's 10^22 newton meters. You know, they want magnitude. So somebody has empirically correlated these things. So they've produced a magnitude scale, MW, which is basically means the it's MW. I'm not quite sure why there's W, but MW is the moment magnitude scale. And they'll tell the newspaper reporters that the moment magnitude was 5 or 6 or something like that. So somebody has invented this scale. So it gives a magnitude-like number, which the general public understands and can be given to newspaper reporters. This is how it was obtained. Somebody took a bunch of earthquakes for which there were various magnitudes available. Body wave magnitude, S wave magnitude, local magnitude, and for which the moment magnitude had been calculated using the spectral approach. And they just simply plotted up the seismic moment, if you like, against the other magnitude, and they invented a moment magnitude scale which sort of fit all these other scales in between, say, magnitude about 5 and about 8 or 9, something like that. So between about 5 and 9, most of these other magnitude scales give roughly the same number as this particular line. And that's why it was chosen. It was just chosen to fit the other magnitudes. People tried to correlate, people tried to squeeze as much as possible out of magnitudes. So here they've plotted the seismic moment, proxy for the moment magnitude if you like, against the fault area. Okay, so if you have a magnitude of 10^26 dyne centimetres, then the fault area here, it might be between, let me see, this is square kilometres, so it might be between about 100 square kilometres and 1,000 square kilometres. People have done the same thing with the length of the fault. An earthquake occurs, people would like to know what amount of the fault of interest has broken. So there again, if we have a moment of about 10^26 dyne centimetres, then the length might range from about, say, 15 kilometres to about 50 kilometres. And the nasty thing about this, of course, is that this is a log-log scale, and as they say, if you put any data at all on a log-log scale, you'll get something which you can claim as a straight line. So you could just imagine if this was a linear scale, these data would just be all over the place. And I was working on a hydrofracturing project. this fault. So they pumped this fluid into the ground, then activated a fault. We saw earthquakes along it, measured their magnitudes. They wanted to know, how long is this fault? If I drill here, will I hit it? Do I have to drill here? Is it 1 kilometre long, or two, or three? How far out from this hydrofracture experiment can we drill and still penetrate this new, you know, permeability zone that we've created? And, you know, I was in a very bad position, because how do you estimate that? This is really the only way you can estimate that, and there's such a huge range. So they're not going to be interested if I say, well, it could be anywhere between 1 and 50 kilometres. So I ended up telling them that the best measure of this was the length of the earthquake zone, not necessarily magnitude. So, you know, you kind of think that potentially there should be information in here, but at the moment, kind of teasing out the important information that we need, which might be the dimensions of the fault, is a little bit not a mature process, one could say. Okay, let's move on to fractals and B, which is the subject of your first summative assignment. So when is this due in, by the way? 10th or 11th, is it? Okay, got a couple of weeks to do this. If we plot the, on a logarithmic scale, the cumulative number of earthquakes against the magnitude, then you get a linear plot. And this is an empirical observation. People plotted these things up, and they found that they got that. Earthquakes are a fractal phenomenon, so there are rather few big ones, but there are many, 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 many little ones. And you know, the relationship is logarithmic. So this is, many things in nature are fractal like this. Trees, genius students, you know, you'll get a few genius students and lots and lots and lots of not quite so genius students. You get the very occasional excellent lecturer, but then there are probably lots of rather poor lecturers. It's the same. It's the same with almost any natural phenomenon. There aren't very many elephants, but there are a gazillion ants. This is the same. When we're up at these big magnitudes here, magnitude 8, you can see that we're down at 10 to the naught here, so there are just maybe, in this particular data set, there are just a couple of these magnitude 8 earthquakes. But if you look at magnitude 6 earthquakes, then in the same region, which could be any region, Britain or anywhere else, there might have been, say, 500 of those smaller ones. The equation that governs them is this, log to base n. Do you like a sweet to Amin? I've got some candy in here. So this is the equation that governs it, log to base n, and n is the cumulative number of earthquakes. So if you take any point here, let's just say magnitude 6, this is the number of earthquakes equal to 6 or below. So you're adding, greater than 6 or below, greater than 6 or below. So you're adding, if you go down in magnitude, you're just adding earthquakes all the time. Greater than 6, I misspoke. For a point here, you would add up the numbers of earthquakes greater than 6. At this point, it would be the number of earthquakes greater than. So this line is always going to go up, it's never going to go down. It's a linear relationship, so we just get this log base m equals a minus bm, where a is, of course, the intercept and b is the negative slope. So, for the world, B is approximately 1, which is quite strange, a nice neat number, isn't it? It's about 1. So, in the world, we have about 1 magnitude 8 earthquake per year. So, in the newspapers published reports saying, you know, oh my god, there's been a damaging earthquake in Japan, magnitude 8, and everybody there are 10 magnitude 7s somewhere in the world every year. There are 100 magnitude 6s. And Ahmed, can you tell us how many 5s there will be? If there's 1 magnitude 8, 10 magnitude 7s, 100 magnitude 6s, how many magnitude 5s will there be?
Thousand,
thank you. Maximum likelihood is a nice equation for those that like them. Let me explain it first. We want to put a straight line through this graph in order to get our slope. Okay. We're now getting on to stuff that you've got to put in your continuous assessment work. Okay, so listen carefully. If you remember, I said before that every year people do rather disappointingly on this, because although the questions look as though they're very simple, they're actually quite complicated. I'm going to be talking about these concepts now. So, first one is that as we get further and further up the scale here into these very, very large earthquakes, the number of earthquakes, the number of data on which these points depend, gets smaller and smaller. So there might just be one or two or three or four of these little earthquakes here. So the position plotted here on this graph is not very accurate, is it? I mean, if you're plotting up the earthquakes, you know, that have occurred this year so far, and just before you plot this point here, there's a big magnitude 8 somewhere in England, then obviously this point would suddenly jump up to a different position, wouldn't it? Just dependent on, you know, the time period or something like this. These points, on the other hand, they're dependent on hundreds or even thousands of earthquakes. So if a few extra earthquakes occurred in your data set, the position of these points would not change. In other words, these points are known more accurately, if you like, than these points here. So when you fit a straight line, you can't use least squares. You have to use a method which heavily weights the accurate data, and it has a very small weight for the non-accurate data. And this method is known as maximum likelihood. And here is the equation for the B value, the slope of the line calculated using maximum likelihood. And as you can see, B is not only here on the left-hand side, but it's also in the exponent of both the numerator here and the denominator. So this is not an easy equation to solve. You can't just plug numbers in and calculate it. You have to do it using a computer program and by an iterative method. Okay. So, not so easy. Okay. If you're doing it by hand, okay, this is this line here. I can't remember where I got this this out of a book, but it's questionable whether this line is drawn in the correct way, because it looks to me as though this line has been drawn to basically ignore these three points here, and then to fit everything, all the rest of them sort of fairly uniformly. If I'd been drawing this, I would have drawn a line that went through these points here. Heavily weight these points, and so it fit these points better than it fits these less accurate points. So probably somebody's just done this by eye, just trying to fit all the points instead of downweighting the upweighting the small ones. The next feature I want to point out is how this sort of tails off here. So, notwithstanding what I just said, you know, whether I've drawn this in a way I think is correct, or whether you take what this particular worker has drawn, we're still looking at a drop-off here. Now, there aren't as many 8.2s as you think there ought to be. They should be up here. And of course, we do see this as you get up to bigger magnitudes. This is a real effect, because there must be an upper limit to the size of an earthquake that can occur. The biggest earthquake you could get would be if the whole lithosphere fractured along the biggest fault segment that exists in the world. This upper limit is going to be somewhere around magnitude 10. We've never recorded a magnitude 10 earthquake, but we have recorded magnitude 9.3s, 9.4s, 9.5s. And I think, let me check, see if I'm right or not, but the obviously that's very important for designing buildings to withstand disasters. You can tell the engineers, well, we're certain that shaking is not going to be stronger than this. That's got to be the maximum. So the question is how you find this, and people have tried different approaches. So here we've got a sort of upside down scale here where this is the moment and this is the surface wave magnitude. Okay. So as we get up to these very, very big numbers here, this particular interpreter has said, well, we can liken this to three straight lines here. Other people have applied asymptotic approaches, Gumbel statistics, and they've said, well, this is some sort of exponent. Okay, let's fit it to one curve. You could say, well, why don't we let the data decide? Why don't we do statistical tests and see if the data fit best a straight line or an asymptote? But the trouble is you've got very few data. You've only got one or two or three earthquakes of these enormous sizes. So your errors are very big. But obviously, you know, if somebody's interested in making a breakthrough, then that's one thing they could look at, isn't it? And how we could get better estimates of the maximum theoretical magnitude from the data. Okay, here's a little mind blender. People suggested in the early days of earthquake seismology that maybe you could relieve stress, for example, on the San Andreas fault zone by pumping fluids into the fault zone and causing lots of little earthquakes, so a big one never occurred. That was actually really suggested. Okay. For smaller and larger earthquakes, consider the relative amounts of energy released and their relative numbers. Would this suggestion work? If you pump fluids in and you cause lots and lots of little small earthquakes, magnitude 5s, magnitude 6s, could you prevent? Who answered that? You? Why not? So can somebody think? In fact, you're correct. Prevent, say, a magnitude 7, you'd have to produce 30 magnitude 6s. Because of the fractal nature of earthquakes, you only produce 10. As soon as you produce 10 magnitude 6s, there'll be one magnitude 7. Because you're generating artificially earthquakes, that doesn't change the fractal distribution. That's always roughly 1. So, you know, you can pump your fluid in, you can cause lots of earthquakes, but you'll still cause sequences where there's, you know, for every 10 magnitude 6s, there'll be 1 magnitude 7. And you cannot, you know, you can't generate 30 magnitude 6s in order to release the energy of 1 magnitude 7. Good effort. Okay, very quickly, scooting through the rest. Earthquake hazard in the UK. You may think that it's all happening in California, but it isn't. We have a lot of earthquakes in the UK. Nobody knows why. I've just remembered a fourth-year project I was going to offer. And I was talking to Fawaz, a Syrian research fellow, about this. And by the time I got home, I'd forgotten what the project was. And I just remembered what it was. I'm going to set a fourth-year project where I tell people why do earthquakes occur in England, investigate this. I personally have no idea, and I know of nobody else who has any idea. It's all up to you. Britain is geologically the same. have lots of seismometers in Ireland, and although this is all this province here is geologically the same, we've got lots of earthquakes here and none there. I think they've now recorded about 3 or 4 earthquakes here. It's almost completely aseismic. Nobody knows why. We know why earthquakes occur in California. Why are they occurring in Britain, not Ireland?
Is there any theory at all, any hypothesis at all?
The only hypothesis I've come across is that there's a residual isostatic uplift still occurring here from the younger Dryas ice cap. But people have investigated the stress pattern that would be induced by that if it were occurring, and they've found that it doesn't agree with the earthquake data. So that theory's kind of been shown not to be consistent with the observations. So, you know, whoever can explain this can immediately get a paper out in Nature, and then they'll be famous, and they'll be offered a PhD with full scholarship funding. So we do occasionally have a sort of interesting earthquake. This church was, the church steeple was damaged by an earthquake in 1884. You can go to the BGS website, read about this, and this is what earthquakes in Britain look like. So we start to see this asymptotic tailing off at high magnitude, round about magnitude 6. There has been a magnitude 6.1 earthquake in Britain. This was down south, London way. So we can get quite exciting earthquakes in the UK. And when we build nuclear power stations, there has to be a seismic hazard assessment done. Because, whereas, you know, if a few houses fell down, well, of course, that's not very good, but it's not exactly a national disaster. It's not like Fukushima, is it? You know, if an earthquake occurred and a nuclear power station was damaged, then it would be a national catastrophe. So although the risk is low, you know, the possible consequences are high, and so an assessment has to be done. Maximum magnitude for the world, 9.2, this is now being exceeded, so obviously I should update this. And let's have a 10-minute break now, and we'll continue the practical